Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/Rob Wolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cat's worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited today. Our guest today is able to bridge all the topics that I really hold near and dear, nutrition, medicine, sustainability. Dr. Charles Sidner, owner of Braeburn Farms. He's been a rancher for almost 60 years. He's a neurologist and an ophthalmologist. Doc, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Really good. Like you're a little bit ahead of me in the day, so it's still late morning for me, early afternoon, I guess, for you. So
yes,
yeah. So, Doc, before we started recording, you actually mentioned a little bit of your, you know, kind of, I guess you were very, very early on the paleo scene. Can you give some folks a little bit of your background and how you came to look at this kind of ancestral diet model?
Yes, I can. It had to do with just stumbling really across some papers by Loren Cordain back in the mid 90s, and it was a very interesting discovery, because some of his early papers compared, say, elk and venison and feedlot beef and grass fed beef, and it was interesting because when I was younger and on the ranch in Montana back in the 60s, the beef that we ate was always right off the ranch, and it dawned on me that for much of my life I'd eaten grass-fed beef. I didn't know that it was any. I would not have known that it was any different.
It was just the cow that was out there. Right?
It was just the way. This was right. The way we did things, and we would slaughter a cow and put it in our cooler, and then we would butcher it up and have that for the next couple of months, and then do another one, and so on. And that was really interesting, because it started me on the idea of fats, what kind of fats I needed. And then I think it was Mary Enig's book. I think she wrote a book on I forget what the title of it was, but Good Fats, Bad Fats, something like that.
Right.
So I decided I would go back, because I do have a bit of a background in biochemistry. Went back and started looking at that, and that pushed me further down the road toward looking at a diet. And then I had a real epiphany in 2001, and it's a very long story, not worth the telling, but suffice it to say that because of some cattle sales and so on, the price of beef on 9/11 for feeder cattle dropped about 8 to 10 cents a pound, and I had some 250,000 pounds to go out, and I took a haircut.
Wow!
And when that occurred, just a whole lot of things that I had been working on. There was Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America. I had gone and taken a course on stocker cattle with Joel Salatin. I had been reading The Stockman Grass Farmer, which is Alan Nation's publication. And all of these things were beginning to just change my complete perception of diet and cattle and how they should be cared for. And then you can add into that the issue of climate change, which early on, even in the 90s, when the book on there were a couple of early books, The End of Nature and so on, had been written about climate change, and I began to look at that data, and then it dawned on me that what we do on the farm is extremely important to health in many ways. You have to broaden your definition of health, and then you start looking at it very differently. What effect does the total environment have on the health of the cow, and what does that mean in terms of the product, and how do you put that together with a healthy lifestyle? And I came to the feeling that sometimes the iatrogenic effects from medicine were as great as the beneficial effects in some cases.
Right.
So it was just a journey, really. It was a journey away from the old industrial agricultural model, and I could just no longer accept that based on the data that I was looking at. So that's what brought me into the grass-fed beef market. And my first grass-fed beef cows, I had to change the type of cow I raised and had to develop systems to do this. But my first grass-fed beef was in 2005 that I took 10 cows to the slaughterhouse, put them in a big freezer I'd put on the farm. And I thought I would have to eat every one of them. I could not find anybody. I couldn't find anybody that knew what I was talking about.
Right.
We were ahead of the curve. And I've been extremely gratified to see just so many people. And the paleo diet concept has been a really interesting one for me, because I basically just changed what I did many years ago, really around 2000 or so, not to be nuts about it, but to just say, okay, we'll make it, fats and protein are good, and carbohydrates we need to regulate, and organic is better than non-organic, and local trumps organic. So that just brought me to where I started on this course.
That's a remarkably simple but effective heuristic. That's really amazing. I love that. And I really love that you mentioned Lauren's early papers on the fat mass of wild game versus conventionally raised or even grass finished animals. There's been a lot of contention in the interwebs about, how much fat one should or should not eat, how much fat one should or should not eat from animal origin and whatnot. And Lauren did some really interesting detective work in that he looked at kind of an upper and lower bound bracketing. Where does protein toxicity begin? It's about like 30-35% of total calories from protein. And so you can't go too much higher than that for extended periods of times. And then he looked at the total carcass weight, like the brains and the marrow and the sinew and everything. And although there's a decent amount of fat on a large animal, it's really not that much as a percentage, particularly a wild game. And More domesticated animals tend to have a little bit higher fat mass, even if they're grass-fed, just because they're not nearly as active. So it's if we were able to kind of go back and look at some of his work, we have a really good benchmark for saying, well, here are some starting points for really intelligently talking about this topic, and it would seem to fix a lot of the problems that have arisen for folks. It's very, very interesting. Doc, you do some work with Aaron Woolman and the folks with and I'm blanking on the name of the butcher shop. I just had them on about 3 months ago. Remind me the name of the outfit.
Left Bank Butchery.
Left Bank Butchery. Sorry. Yeah. So I met Aaron on a hunting trip not long ago. It's fascinating to me that the market demand has increased so much for pastured meat in the last maybe 10 years. I was going through a Whole Foods market on the East Coast, actually, and a gal working in the meat department said, "Are you Rob Wolf?" And I was like, "Maybe, you know, who wants to know?" And and I said, "Yeah, that's me." And she said, "Well, you know, I'm the meat buyer for essentially like Whole Foods nationally." And she said that I was one of the most reviled and hated individuals in the corporate structure of Whole Foods because the paleo diet work, and particularly apparently me, because I've really been beating this sustainability plus paleo diet message. She felt like I was the reason that grass-fed meat, it just basically exists in Whole Foods. Like about 8 years ago, there was a mandate that went out by John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, saying that they wanted to disband all of the meat departments, wanted to take all the animal products out of the prepared foods department and just have a completely vegan vegetarian store. And the market forces have been so powerful the opposite direction that they've had to kind of stay contemporary with that. But it really pissed a number of people off, and apparently their ire was kind of focused at me. But how did you get hooked up with the Left Bank folks?
Well, Ross Flynn, who runs Left Bank Butchery, was an intern with me.
Oh, okay.
And with Eliza McLean as well. And then as he went along, he got very interested in how do you break down a pig? And then he began expanding into cattle. How would he do that? He went out to the West Coast and took a fairly extended course in how to do these things and came back. And then there was another young man, Justin Metis, who opened a butcher shop in Durham, North Carolina, called Rose's Meat and Sweet Shop. His wife was a pastry chef, Chez Panay, and he had been trained in what we refer to as seam or single muscle butchery. And so I began to supply Rose's Meat and Sweet Shop and then Left Bank Butchery. And what's fascinating about that is, as I mentioned in 2005, I had a terrible time trying to sell it because it was just such an unusual product, and the general public had bought in hook, line, and sinker to the great old canard, which is high quality grain fed beef, and that mantra had been. Had been preached so long that people believed it, and it was difficult to get them to understand this. And then to go into the biochemistry, everybody's eyes just sort of glaze over, and they don't want to hear it. But it was you and Mark Sisson and Lauren Cordain and any number of others who have talked about this extensively. Over the years, and you guys have really done a super job in getting the word out that there's a great deal of substance to this. So I was thrilled, and when these guys started up, because it used to be that I would spend a good deal of time marketing meat, and now I spend my time figuring out how to grow it better. And let Rose's Meat and Sweet Shop and Left Bank Butchery. I let them do the marketing. And nice. And I think it's just great that we've got the local butcher shop back on the street. It just, I mean, these guys are just doing a super job. And so at this point, instead of being market poor and product rich, I'm the opposite. I'm product poor and market rich. I could sell 2, 3, 4 times what I raise now. And indeed, another organization has formed with some friends of mine that called Firsthand Foods. And they, what they're doing is consolidating a lot of small farmers into one marketing approach. In other words, you have lots of people in North Carolina that raise a few cows, so the average herd in this state, I think, is like 25. And that's kind of hard to have a real program around. Mm-hmm. So these folks are just bringing many of the smaller people into play through their organization, and then they're the distributor, if you will.
And tell me the name of that outfit again.
That's called Firsthand Foods.
They're
based in Durham. Yeah. Okay.
That is outstanding. You know, my gut sense on all this stuff has been that decentralized production with robust centralized distribution is the way that we're going to get the maximum leverage out of this. And I had guessed this a long, long time ago, had no empirical or other data to support it. It was just kind of a gut sense, you know, student of economics and whatnot, decentralized systems, thinking that was kind of the way it would work out. And I'm a little bit tickled to see that it's heading that way. I talked to Russ Konser. He was involved with the short documentary Soil Carbon Cowboys, where they...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. And there's some really fascinating stuff coming out with all that. Charles, it is so antithetical or heretical to make this statement that grazing animals are not only an important part of the ecology, but maybe like a linchpin keystone animal when we look at carbon sequestration, water sequestration, renutrification of the soil. You know, it's kind of like this whole system was designed with animals interfacing with large herbivores and a plenitude of other animals, clearly. But, you know, political and kind of social flows have been pushing towards this kind of vegetarian, vegan type of scheme. And I don't really see how a dynamic ecosystem works where you just have plants produced and no animals interfacing with them and no predatory pressure on the animals consuming the plants. I mean, is that getting too heady and out in the weeds, or what do you think about that?
No, that's not getting heavy at all. There is practically no natural system anywhere that doesn't have a mix of animals and plants. And for my model, I have used the Great Plains of North America. And I like to tell people, if they pushed you out of the plane and you floated down in your parachute in the year 1300 and landed on the Great Plains of North America, what would you see?
You'd probably land on a bison. You wouldn't even land on the ground.
But there were some 50 million of them, apparently. And for millennia, they had been going north in the spring and south in the fall. They would come, the original descriptions by Captain Goodnight and others in Kansas and out in that area, they would talk about the ground would be blotted out for 5 days as the herd of buffalo would be passing, going north, constantly moving with a group of predators around the perimeter. In other words, the safe place for a grazing animal is in the middle of the herd. If you get lame and you fall back, the predators eat you. And so you look at that system, and then just apply it to the Serengeti and to other great grasslands. The steppes of Asia was very much the same thing, so what we had was grasslands that existed in conjunction with large herbivores, and also if we look at the carbon, the soil organic matter, the carbon in the soil in areas of the great plains that were never plowed or disturbed. It's amazing how much carbon is in the soil, and it has been estimated by some that we have lost up to 70% to 80% of that, because every time we plow, what we do is we simply oxidize. We turn the land over. All that organic matter that's in the soil is then exposed, and it turns into CO2 and goes back into the air. And that's a great deal of where... drawing a blank.
Alan Savory, or
Alan Savory, mm-hmm. comes in with his TED talk. I think that was in January of 2014, and he made the statement that all of the CO2 emitted since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution could be sequestered in the ground now. Shortly after that, there were some very heavy responses to that, and I think appropriate skepticism. I think we have to be careful in making statements like that, because everybody's scared to death when you say that, because what they say, well, oh, don't say that, because we've been trying desperately to get people to use fewer fossil fuels, to put fewer carbon molecules into the air. And here you are saying, oh, don't worry about that. We'll just sequester it in the ground. The truth probably lies in the middle.
Right.
I think there's no question that the tremendous effort of a small group of people within NRCS. Are you familiar with Natural Resource Conservation Service?
I am not.
Okay, well, that's part of USDA, and okay. Within that is a group, Ray Archuleta and Doug Peterson, the guy up in North Dakota whose name I'm blanking on, but these folks realize that soil organic matter was the key. And it is, and they have been preaching this model for some time. And farmers in the real industrial world are beginning to listen, because what they're saying is, through the use of cover crops, let us say that we plant our soybeans and then we harvest those soybeans and come back immediately on that and plant a winter cover crop, mm-hmm. so that the ground is never, ever barren and we never break the surface of the soil. So we're going to plant cover crops. Then in the spring, we're going to roll them down. We might plant corn. I don't like the idea of, quote, burning them down with chemicals, because I just don't, just intuitively, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. But, I think we have to take our triumphs where we find them. And the fact that industrial farmers are doing this, what they're finding is that the soil gets better and better and better as we go forward. And I don't know if you are familiar with Gabe Brown up in North Dakota.
Yes.
But,
yep.
But Gabe's place, I went up there in my son from Ronan, and I went over to his place in the summer of 2014. And to look at his place was just amazing. 8% soil organic matter in most pastures. And he's just a beautiful example of someone who's been using cover crops and no-till for 20 years, and the results are just utterly dramatic. And It is indeed the soil carbon sequestration is a real key to this, and I would even go so far as to quote a person. I went to a conference in Montana some years ago, and a guy named Greg Simons, who's a very well-known ranch manager, made a statement that it really caught my attention, and he said there will come a time when farmers are paid more for their ecological services than for their products. And that stuck in my mind, and I think we are coming full circle, because I think that's what we're going to see, that in time, farmers are going to be, we're going to look at water, soil, and air, and we're going to say who is in a better situation to help us than the American, well, than farmers all over the world, not just America, but everywhere. And so I don't think you've gone too far at all when you make those statements. And what's really, I think we go even further than that, and we say that when soil becomes healthy, when the biology of the soil, not the chemistry, but the biology of the soil is really good with an appropriate fungal bacterial ratio and so on, plants become healthier, animals become healthier, the meat that we eat becomes better. I realize this is a systems approach, and there are a great many people, the Monsantos of the world, that stand to lose a great deal if this is the norm. And as a matter of fact, Monsanto is now has a whole group looking at soil biology, because they're not stupid. They're looking at this and trying to figure out how they're going to play a role in it. But what's really fascinating is to look at the farmers, Dave Brandt, Gabe Brown, and many others around the country who have done this for a long time and have shown us the way. And that small group within NRCS is really working hard to have a little bit of a sea change in the attitude of USDA. And it's going to take a long time to do that, but I think the evidence keeps growing. And, you know, the truth is sometimes a bit ugly and inconvenient, but over time it's going to have an effect.
Right, right. And, you know, it's when I look at the history of this story, we had it, you can call it success, you know, the Green Revolution and whatnot had some really interesting inputs that made it occur, one of which was very inexpensive fossil fuels. And all of us have lived during that time, but we're living at a time now that I've seen most people kind of break the fossil fuel story down to either we have centuries worth of the stuff left, or other people are saying, well, we're running out of it immediately. And I to your point, kind of a middle ground, some folks that I follow, they talk about peak cheap oil and peak cheap energy. There is lots and lots of this stuff in the ground, but the benefit of obtaining an energy source is that you get more energy out than what you put in. It's just optimum foraging strategy that animals use to survive, you know. And we're reaching a point where the difference between the energy that we get out versus the energy that we put in is becoming ever skinnier. And that will put some really big constraints on the systems that we have developed. And if you have a food production system that is really tied to massive energetic inputs, you know, growing row crops to feed to animals and centralized production and then massive distances to distribute the food, that all works when gas is pretty cheap. It really fails when oil becomes expensive. During 2008, during the financial crisis, quite a number of beef cattle, if I recall, were put down because the feed became so expensive that they couldn't feed them.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are a couple of subjects you mentioned, and Richard Heinberg wrote a book called Peak Everything. And in that, he simply points out it's not just oil that's going to peak. It's going to be phosphate, which is mined for agricultural purposes, potash, mined for agricultural purposes, and nitrogen. Nitrogen is really that we use for agricultural purposes is made from nitrogen in the air and natural gas. So in a sense, you're mining natural gas to get nitrogen as well. All of these things are mined. and there will come a time when the low-hanging fruit has all been picked, and I think we can say that about oil at the present time. I think Richard Heinberg says it takes at least $100 to get a barrel of oil out of the ground in the Bakken up in North Dakota. The tar sands, even higher. And then I think the negative externalities of those ventures have to be factored into this. I think the folks in the fossil fuel industry were just thrilled when all of a sudden we started hitting oil with all the fracturing and all that sort of thing. And they said, see, these peak oil nuts were just all crazy. And I think the peak oil nuts were dead on the money. It's just that you never can anticipate everything that's going to happen. And I think your point is well taken. Peak cheap oil is what we have seen. And there have been people who even say peak oil actually occurred in 2014-15, and that we will begin to see a decrease over time. That having been said, the whole point of creating agriculture, which is based on fewer and fewer inputs, that is the use of cover crops, the total avoidance of any sort of tillage, trying to get away from the chemicals that are used. The chemical companies love to tell us that all these chemicals are very safe, and EPA has done these studies, and therefore you don't have to worry about it. And from a medical point of view, I just simply look at that and am a little disturbed about it, because in the beginning when we started using these chemicals, people didn't take many precautions. We are seeing a lot of problems that I think may be in older farmers, the incidence of Parkinson's disease and other things that that may be related to this. They say it doesn't harm anything, and I have to say that in whose time frame, meaning right. that, for instance, Roundup is a chelating agent, and once it chelates metals in the soil, it has a half-life of 22 years. It's essentially safe for right now, but what are the long-term consequences? Likewise, when we start treating soil well, we get increased carbon. We have way less need for phosphates and potashes, and legumes can provide our nitrogen. We don't need the Haber-Bosch process to do that any longer. And for instance, on my farm, I'm trying to get to the point where I have my farm's about 510 acres, and I'm trying to get to the point where I use 1 gallon of diesel fuel per acre per year. Huh. So we're getting it down. We haven't gotten rid of it, but we are working toward that. You also mentioned the Green Revolution, and Joel Bourne's new book has just come out, and he really has a fascinating review of the Green Revolution and what's happened. And Norman Borlaug produced that dwarf wheat. The problem was it required lots of water and lots of nitrogen and lots of chemicals. And the Green Revolution has basically, in many parts of the world, has run its course. We're not seeing the increases in yields that we used to see. Many people are looking at agriculture and saying, You know, some of the traditional ways of doing agriculture were much better from a long-term point of view. And I think you're going to see you're going to see that the Green Revolution is going to fade in the rearview mirror and be replaced by a much more ecologically sound approach.
Man, I certainly hope so. We definitely, you know, it's funny. I always find myself, whether it's nutrition or politics or my view of sustainability, I always seem to find myself in the lunatic fringe. I never seem to come up with an idea that's at all well embraced by the mainstream. So I find myself in a battle constantly. And I don't think that that's a personality failure on my part. I hope not. I think it's because I, you know, again, looking at some systems biology, a little bit of economics, and trying to put a longer term picture on this stuff, then some of these stories kind of play out. And I have this sneaky suspicion as energy becomes more of a rarefied commodity, that we're really going to have to think through the way that we do things. You know, do suburbs work the way that they've historically worked? You know, can you, I live in Reno, Nevada, and, you know, people love having a nice green lawn through the summer. We are a desert, although this area was grassland at one time, but that was a very different story. You actually need grazing animals to make that thing happen. Like we are in that very advanced desertification process that Alan Savory described. If we had goats and camels and you know, things like that roaming the surface of the area the way that it did about 6,000 years ago, we would probably have a very different environment here. But right now it's all sagebrush and huge gullies from the occasional, you know, thunderstorms that we get. And so you get a lot of runoff. You have a completely oxidized soil base and no carbon to speak of in the soil. And I feel like we're in a very interesting race of finding ways to make all this stuff economically palatable and sociologically palatable enough to really give it some legs and get it moving forward.
You're absolutely right. I was just in one of my other interests is in local economies. How do we promote local economies? I think multinational publicly traded companies are fine, but I don't think they have a soul, nor do I think they're interested in the people who live in communities all over the world. And so there's a group called BALI, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, that I work with and attend their conference every year. And we had it in Phoenix just 2 weeks ago. Huh. And I was struck, too. In flying into this, I looked down on a desert landscape, and all of a sudden I'm looking at a golf course. And I realize that people retire there and so on because they want to play golf and so on. But I'm also looking at this and thinking, wait a minute, we're taking water out of the Colorado River to water these lawns, which are bluegrass, and bluegrass never, ever grew here. And I was in Reno not too long ago, the same thing. You look at this and you say, where does, you know, this is basically Europeans bringing their green landscape with them. I would occasionally in Phoenix, I would come across a lawn that was just total desert landscape. And I thought it's so much more appropriate than trying to force the desert to grow bluegrass.
Right.
So your observation is an excellent one.
Oh, thank you. It's historically been a pretty unpopular position trying to talk about economics and sustainability. I've had some pretty good success helping people with medical issues and, you know, getting in shape and looking good in a bikini and, you know, looking good in their skinny jeans and all that. But when you start bringing up these topics of sustainability and some of the economic implications, people get really cranky, and I think it jolts them. You know, we have such busy lives, and we just kind of want to have a little bit of a downhill grade. We want a little momentum, and every single thing that we do doesn't want to feel like a slog. And so when you've changed your diet already and, you know, you feel pretty good from that and you feel like some good stuff is happening, and then you start thinking about some of the bigger ecological and economic considerations of the systems that we have and what the implications are if energy gets very expensive and whatnot, it's not a lot of fun. Like, it's just more work. But my view on this is that, you know, we're kind of in a airplane that's maybe running on fumes, and we've got a chance to jettison a bunch of luggage that we don't want to make this thing a glider for as long as we can. And then we've got an opportunity for a soft landing versus heading nose first into a mountainside.
You are dead on the money. Economics and sustainability are two of the terms that create a great deal of angst. And when I think of sustainability, I truly think of climate change. I think the data on climate change, if you just look at the raw data, it is very difficult for me not to say that it's very real. However, think about what if we were to take the idea of climate change and carry it to its logical conclusion, we would say that getting rid of fossil fuels would be a very attractive thing to do. Well, the fossil fuel industry has fought back mightily against that. ExxonMobil used to spend millions of dollars saying it ain't so. There's the Hudson Institute and the Heartland Institute and all of these outfits that have basically been hired by industry to run around saying it isn't true. And then we end up with the Agenda 21 group and the people who think that the whole shift toward an ecologically sound future is capitulating to one world government and all of these crazy things. So it does. You're absolutely correct. I think it makes people very uncomfortable. what we're saying is that the way your daddy lived and your granddaddy lived may not be the way you're going to live. But my take on it is that if we pay attention to these things, our life can be so much better. Living within our ecological means is a wonderful blueprint for the future. It's a future that can go on and on. And it doesn't have a crash at the end of it somewhere, because a fossil fuel future, I think anybody would agree that the fossil fuels are finite. I don't know how many barrels of oil are in the ground, but there's a certain number of them you're never going to be able to get. And as we go closer and closer to that number, it's going to get more and more expensive. And economics are definitely going to push us in a direction of sustainability if we don't kill ourselves first. Those two things go hand in hand, because I think the power of corporations to say we're doing great this way, we're making lots of money, and if you change the paradigm on me, I'm either going to go out of business or I'm going to have to drastically change what I do, and we really don't want to do that. One of my great examples of that is I think the electric car is going to literally take over. And there are some people who feel that by 2030, 2040, you may not see anybody making an internal combustion engine anymore. There's an awful lot of people that's terrible news for.
Right.
Yeah. But think about what its meaning is for the environment and so on. And think of it, look at it as a fabulous opportunity. We're going to change what we do. Are you going to be part of the change? Are you going to be dragged kicking and screaming into the future? So I would not in any way back off of the economics and sustainability issue, because I think that's where you have to carry us. And really and truly, the idea of the paleo diet was simply a look back in time to say there was a time when all of this ran on nature's time and nature's agenda. And then we came along and we tried to change all that. We thought we could take Mother Nature and grab her by the neck and shake the old broad and make her do what we wanted her to do. And we're finding out that no matter how smart or how much money we have, we can't do that. I think it was for me really the paleo diet was a segue into a much broader discussion, which is what you've done as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at some of the evolutionary biology implications and start weaving that into systems biology and economics, then we still have very, very complex stories, but you have some simple heuristics that really explain a lot of things in a pretty understandable fashion, so long as we can operate with some logic and instead of emotional response. If I just throw out the term markets, about 50% of people lose their minds because immediately the implication there are multinational corporations strip mining the planet, and, you know, all this type of stuff. And again, I was not familiar with the Bale outfit, but, you know, I talk constantly about local decentralized governance and food production, and a few states have done some interesting things, like Utah has a state commission planning for what they will do when they no longer receive federal funding for roads and schools. And so those folks are looking ahead and they're saying, we know that this thing isn't going to keep going the way that it's historically gone. Tomorrow is likely to be different than yesterday. And so there are some people that are, you know, putting their heads together and saying, okay, so what does our school system look like if it's just locally funded, like 100%, there's no federal monies coming into that, because there may reach a point where the federal government isn't able to, you know, participate in that process. And, but that, again, like, that's more work, and it's kind of scary, because we've had these systems that have worked pretty well and have provided a really unprecedented degree of comfort. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety about losing that comfort. And my sneaky suspicion is that we can have more enriched, interesting, vibrant lives and still a high degree of comfort if we do some planning to meet the changes. Again, like you said, versus stick our head in the sand and hope that the typhoon goes around us, not right over the top of us.
Yeah. Well, you're just dead on the money with these ideas. I just find that the idea of local economies, the idea of people growing food in the soil where you live, the lack of transportation miles that gets that food to the table, people who live in an area may find that that what the folks do in Sacramento doesn't work in Burlington, North Carolina. There should be many different ways to skin this cat, I'm very much in favor of that sort of approach, as you mentioned in Utah, where they're looking at the future. And again, I just come back to this and say, I think the future is just fantastic. If we are willing to say some of the things we've done in the past are not going to be in our interest in the future, how are we going to deal with them? There are going to be people that are going to be hurt. That's the concept of creative destruction, that as we create new things, we destroy the old. But as we go forward, I, I'm quite the opposite of pessimistic. I'm really extremely optimistic that we do have the opportunity to change this. I don't think we have unlimited time. I think there is a point at which we can push the environment into vicious cycles, which we cannot control. And this is a worry. I mean, it comes back to the old idea of chaos theory, that Mother Nature is chaos personified. There are so many variables in it that we cannot control it. And if we push it to a point where it spins out of control, then we could lose. But I at this point in time, I think that we're just seeing so many wonderful examples of carbon sequestration, the carbon soil challenge, that all of these folks that are out there spreading the word on this stuff, the creative folks that are looking at how do we live our lives differently. You just touched on an issue that is near and dear to me, and that is, does everybody really need to have three cars, live in a 4,000 square foot house in splendid isolation with gates around them and so on? Is that really going to make you happy? And the answer repeatedly by people who have looked at it is a resounding no. Much more participatory communities, walkable communities, communities where people do get together, where we don't have to drive, where we have things close by, we don't have to go to big box stores. There's a whole economic study on big box stores and what their effect on the communities are. I must admit that Walmart is a fantastically
it's incredibly efficient
company and so on. Logistically, they are whizzes at this. But I look at Walmart as nothing more than a vacuum cleaner over the front door, sucking the money out of the folks who live in my community and leaving as little as possible, sending as much as possible to their investors in Hong Kong, Toronto, and London. And so when I start looking at smaller communities with so many of our essential things, the grocery store, two friends of mine and I started a co-op grocery store in Burlington, North Carolina called Company Shops Market. The purpose of it was to reconnect the community to local agriculture, and we now have 60 farmers providing products into that place. There are tons of these examples. The butcher shop at Saks Fifth Avenue, all of these things are examples of communities coming together to create places that are truly fun and tremendous amounts of fossil fuel and so on. It just requires a change in your mental paradigms.
Well, that change in mental paradigm I've been labeling for myself job security. I think I've got a lifetime or plus of work ahead of me on that, but it's really exciting stuff, and it's very I too am heartened. Sometimes it's easy to get negative and pessimistic about this stuff, but one interesting thing is information exchange, social media. We've been able to compare notes in a way that has been impossible in the past. And so if people are open to changing their minds about a topic, it's very easy to kind of put on a different sweater, a different framework, and think about it and see some of the results and, change their minds on a topic. So I am heartened by all that.
And there's also the I look at a bunch of young people are sort of going back to the homesteading idea, and And I run into a lot of these young folks here in North Carolina, and my own son up in Montana, where he grows 90+% of all the food that he eats. The food is just, whenever I go up there, I'm just blown away the good example is last year they had a little raspberry patch and they put up 16 gallons of raspberries.
Wow.
And so I when I go there, all of a sudden my daughter-in-law puts our hors d'oeuvres are frozen raspberries. Oh my goodness. And cherries and peaches and the things that she's put up for the year, and the food is just so tasty and so healthy. They heat with wood. There are just so many things they do that make, and so they don't spend a great deal of money, but boy, they have a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people involved in this, people in their community that are of like mind, and all of these people have different skill sets, and it's really fun to see that there are people who are looking at all these issues and saying, I'm not going to get involved in a big fight with ExxonMobil or somebody like that. What I'm going to do is just demonstrate that a fabulous life can be had with lesser means, but tremendous health. They do a great deal of hiking up in the Mission Mountains and so on, and it's just it's a truly a joy to go out and visit and look at how many young people are participating in this kind of lifestyle. And likewise, here in North Carolina, we're seeing a number of young people who are starting out saying, "I can't afford to build a big house, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a little teeny place, and then I'll add a little bit to it, and so on." They're creating lifestyles that are truly remarkable and full of joy. So it's very nice to watch.
Well, it's very exciting. We just moved out to a 2.5-acre ranch in central Reno, and we have chickens and we have goats on order, and we borrowed our neighbor's horses to take our field down and get it grazed, and we did a little bit of holistic management with the horse rotation, and there were already some fruit trees. We planted a ton of berry bushes. We're getting ready to do a remodel, which will involve some rainwater catchment and gray water treatment and stuff like that. It's interesting. We lived in what you would call kind of a McMansion prior to this. Very, very nice house in a suburb. We got it at the low ebb of the real estate bubbles. We got a great price on it, and it was a good spot to start with. But it was definitely not ticking many, many other boxes for us. And it's interesting. We've been at this new place about a month and a half. And we've been outdoors more here than we were at this other place the 4 years that we were there. It is stunning. And, we have two little girls, one 3-year-old, one 11 months old. And the 3-year-old helps. She pulls her little red flyer wagon around and hauls water and helps us plant blueberries and has become an expert at picking up and carrying the chickens. And, it's just amazing. And it's a much more rich and enjoyable life. And it's a lot of work, but it's oddly enough, I enjoy that a lot more than most of my internet activities at this point. So it's a nice break from my online work.
Well, and you hit on a subject that's also very important to me. I have a 16-month-old grandson here, and I have a 9-year-old granddaughter in Montana. And I look at my granddaughter in Montana, and she's grown up in this environment where they grow all their own food. She's a walking encyclopedia on chickens. I mean, she absolutely loves her chickens. She's got 25 of them or something like that. They all have names, and they all have personalities, and she can tell you all about all the breeds and all that. And I mean, I walk through the garden with her, and she tells me what this plant is and what that plant is and what do you do for it and how do you grow it and all this. And what I find truly fun is to realize they don't even have a television. And this child has never seen television other than they use the computer for nature videos and things like that. She's gotten interested in oceans, and so they get her videos that talk about that. But the lifestyle for our children, if we introduce them to these things and make them participants in it, it's such a better lifestyle than one of television and video games.
I cannot agree more. It's kind of, we do have a TV, although it's only hooked up to the internet. We do an Apple TV hookup, but it's funny. Zoe's, when we lived at the old house, the way that she would start her day is asked to watch a show, and it was usually some sort of like Cat in the Hat, you know, kind of quasi educational show. And she would watch that for a half hour or so while I got breakfast cooked and we got the day going. But since we've moved out to the farmhouse, she wants to be outside playing with her wagon and playing with the chickens, and maybe one day in 10, she wants to watch a show now. And
you're
I completely leave it up to her, but that is completely a self-directed thing, but it's far more fun, far more interesting for her to get up and play with the chickens and play outside and water the tomatoes and whatnot than it is to sit and watch a show. And I think that's pretty cool. Although my iPhone, if she gets a hold of that, which I try to, we really don't do much tablet or phone interface with the kids. If she gets a hold of that, that's pure crack cocaine for her. Like that's a whole other story.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Well, Dr. Sidner, it's been an amazing treat having you on the show. Just so honored to talk to you. Really excited for the work that you're doing. Remind folks where they can find you on the internet.
I have a website, although it's not up to date. It's www.braeburnfarms.com. Maybe you'll stimulate me to get my website. the products that I produce, made a decision some years ago. I had the meat buyer for Whole Foods come, and he looked at my cows and he said, "Wow, this is really fantastic, and we'll take everything you can produce." And I got to thinking about that, and I thought, yeah. Really and truly, very nice folks and so on, but I made that decision to stay in my local community. And then I went a step further, and that was to say I have the real privilege of having young people come as interns on the farm. And when I see one like Ross Flynn, who takes the bull by the horns and goes off to form the butcher shop and so on, my goal is to support them. So my products are not available by internet or very little by people coming to the farm, although I participate in the Carolina Farm Stewardship Farm Tour, and I give a lot of tours on the farm. For the most part, my products are available in a couple of restaurants, a grocery store, and two butcher shops. And I try very hard to keep it local.
That's fantastic. I highly respect that, and it's exciting that we are reaching a point of critical mass that the local meat producers are becoming less and less reliant on the need to freeze and styrofoam pack their meat and ship it across the country to be able to just keep their operation going. I think that there's some arguments for doing that early on for some folks, but we're really reaching a critical mass where that's becoming unnecessary for the most part. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of large meat companies whose model is to freeze it and pack it in styrofoam and send it all over the world. And I have no problem with that. It's just that it seems to me we're marinating it in diesel fuel and kerosene.
Right. Absolutely.
Not what I want to do.
Right. Fantastic. Well, Doc, it's been great having you on the show. Would you be game for coming on maybe in 6 months and we'll chat some more? Maybe we can do a Q&A. I can do a blog post, ask folks for some questions, and maybe we can do a Q&A next time.
Sure, I'd love to. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed reading your material in the past, and I look forward to it. Sure.
Fantastic, Doc. Well, thank you again, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.